Keith Hammer. I'm the chair of Swan View Coalition.
Arlene Montgomery. I'm the program director for Friends of the Wild Swan.
So thanks for joining us on Montana Public Radio. This new Flathead National Forest Plan, big deal, significant?
Absolutely. This is what's going to guide management on the Flathead National Forest for at least the next 15 years. So this is really an important document that needs to be thoroughly reviewed.
It's a 180-degree change from where the Flathead Forest was headed in 2006 when it drafted its first revision and then put that on hold until this year. And so this is quite a reversal, so it's really significant in that way as well.
So tell me what's different in this draft versus the one they were working on in 2006.
The draft that they came out with to the public for comment in 2006, it cut the suitable timber base in about half, down to 328,000 acres, in order to better address the needs of fish and wildlife and water quality. And now this plan basically puts almost all of that back into the timber base, which is where they schedule logging and have it on a regular schedule. And so, you know, we'll have those impacts reinstated, you know, on grizzly bears and lynx and wolverine and other fur bears, fish, bull trout, those kind of things.
When I talked to Joe Kruger about the plan, he said that the suitable timber area was something over 600,000 acres, but by the time you subtract out riparian areas and stuff like that, it comes down to about 500,000 acres as suitable for timber harvest. What do you guys think of that number?
One of the things that was really jumped out at me is that this draft proposed action actually does away with the measurable standards for riparian areas. And so they have no measures, no metrics. They've gotten rid of all of that, and it's more discretionary. And so I think that they can subtract out those riparian areas, but they're still allowing themselves to go into those riparian areas.
And I assume you see that as a problem.
Definitely. You know, because the forest plan that was amended in 1995 for fish had measurable standards for temperature, for pool frequency, and other metrics that determine good fish habitat. And that's especially important for bull trout, because bull trout require the coldest and cleanest water of all salmonids. And so you need to have some kind of measure of, okay, are you moving forward and towards good fish habitat, or are you backsliding and impacting fish habitat? If you don't have a measure, you can't tell.
I guess I'm probably asking two questions here then. Is you know, one, the 500,000 acres that the Forest Service says is suitable for timber harvest. I mean, how do you feel about that number in general? And then beyond that, it sounds like it's, you know, there's more specificity beyond just how many acres they're designating. It's whether or not those acres are, you can determine whether or not they're actually suitable.
Well, I mean, that's where some of the smoke and mirrors comes in. I mean, just about everywhere you look in this plan, they're using different numbers, 500,000, 600,000. And that's where the 2006 draft, I think, was more honest, that they looked at where we have these really sensitive areas, you know, to have security for grizzly bears and clean cold water for bull trout, those types of things. They pulled it out of the timber base. And that didn't mean they couldn't do some logging there, but it was sensitive enough that we shouldn't schedule it. We shouldn't count on getting a certain amount of timber out of those areas. And now what they're doing is they're greatly inflating that timber base again, and then basically saying, and off of that, we should be able to log 28 million board feet per year. But if Congress gives us a bunch more money, we'll cut as much as they want, basically. And that's the reason they're reinflating the timber base. And then you couple that with doing away with these enforceable standards for grizzly bear and riparian areas, streamside zones for bull trout, and you come up with this really ugly mix of, it's all just, the only thing that's a constraint is money from Congress. And we're hearing that pretty loud and clear from the Flathead Forest.
I guess we went straight to logging as the primary issue in the forest plan. And is that, for the two of you, is that the number one issue that you're looking at in the forest plan, or are there other things that you think are equally important or commensurate with logging in terms of your concerns for the future of the Flathead?
Well, I think, you know, we're looking at impacts and what in the forest plan will impact wildlife, fish, water quality. I mean, so that could encompass, you know, logging would be the main thing, roads and how many roads they're maintaining on the landscape. And then also, you know, motorized recreation and those impacts in grizzly bear habitat, lynx critical habitat. So I think it's all encompassing, but I think the logging is the biggest thing that really jumps out in this as the biggest impact in this plan.
Primarily, a lot of what we're concerned about is wildlife connectivity. And so it's not just a matter that even if the Forest Service was to say, let's take all of our high elevation roadless areas and make it wilderness, which they're not. They're only recommending something less than a third or somewhere around a third of their roadless areas. Even if you had good connection in those high elevation areas, the logging issue comes up in the more mid and lower elevation areas that are equally critical to wildlife habitat, security, and migration and connectivity. So that's where these two issues, roadless wilderness and the timber base and the logging program, kind of meet.
You know, the whole reason we're talking about the future of the Flathead is because we're in this planning process, but outside of the sort of rubric they've set up with the draft plan, what's your vision for the future of the Flathead? What do you want to see on the Flathead National Forest for, I guess, the next 10 or 20 years or however long something like this might be in effect?
Well, as a matter of fact, Keith and I did submit this to the Flathead over a year ago. It's the best available science and contains management recommendations, and it's sort of our vision. We call it the citizen revision for the Flathead because the new planning rule requires that they use the best available science. And so we wanted to make sure with a comprehensive bibliography that information was before the Flathead. I can't see in this proposed action where they really used it to the extent we would like them to, but we're hopeful that they will develop an alternative in their NEPA document that incorporates what we see as the best available science to protect wildlife.
Can you give me a thumbnail of what's in your citizen revision document and how that differs significantly from what's in the Forest Service's proposed plan for the Flathead?
Well, in our citizen revision, in the broad brush approach, it takes all roadless lands and would recommend them for wilderness, and takes some other really critical areas for wildlife connectivity and would remove roads and restore those so that they would again function as good wildlife connectivity habitat. And for an example, where this proposed plan of the Flatheads falls way short, the south end of the Whitefish Range, no wilderness recommendations, snowmobiling. The entire north end of the Swan Range, the same thing, it's snowmobiling. Rather than having wildlife security, for instance, the lynx research shows a major lynx corridor that comes down from Canada off the tip of the Whitefish Range, across into the Swan Range, and all the way down to Clearwater Junction. And this severs that. And so that's part of what our citizen revision proposes. And it's patterned in part after what the Wildlife Conservation Society has recommended through John Weaver. He did a report and gave advice upon invitation from the Flathead Forest and issued a special report. And his report for the Northern Swan Range asked for almost all roadless areas to be wilderness. And it asks for much more wilderness in the Whitefish Range than the Forest Service has proposed.
You know, we're, I guess, a couple of years now into the drafting process for the new forest plan. Have you seen any of your concerns or anything that's in the revision incorporated into the forest plan? Do you feel like the Forest Service has been responsive to the kinds of concerns you have, and the draft plan reflects any of your influence?
Well, I guess my quick reply is no.
Yeah, that
But
would
it's not limited to just our proposal in our citizen revision. They've done the same thing with John Weaver's Wildlife Conservation Society report. It's just largely ignored. You know, and the biggest problem here is it's mostly about politics, this forest plan, and it's very little about science. They'll they'll talk a pretty good line about the science, but it's mostly lip service. And that goes back to this lack of having enforceable standards, lack of recommending enough roadless lands as wilderness or to provide that wildlife connectivity that, that these scientists are telling us we need, and especially in the face of climate change that makes these higher elevation roadless lands all the more important.
As the agency that's responsible for responding to all these different points of view and trying to come up with a plan for the forest, what do you see the Forest Service's job as, and how do you think they're doing?
In the meetings that went on, it was more about people just coming in and saying, I want this, I want that, and not really looking at, well, what's the best for the landscape? Our organization is wildlife and habitat based. We want to make sure that there is sufficient quality habitat to support the wildlife that's here, which is phenomenal. We have no other place in the country that has this diversity of wildlife, and it's a big economic driver. And so I really think that that it needs, the Forest Service has to go beyond the me that they hear from people and look at, well, what's the best for the landscape? What's the best for the wildlife and the habitat? Because, you know, that's the what's here that is nowhere else. And I think it's one of the most important things on this forest.
I think there's a perception that that quote unquote environmental groups or quote unquote radical environmental groups just want to say no to any human intrusion, any kind of development, commercial use, logging, things like that. Do you think that there's room for logging on the Flathead?
There's room for logging on the Flathead, but it's more, as we point out in our citizen revision proposal, those lands are more in the front country. And where that makes the most difference, in fact, for people that are concerned about fire right in their backyard, if their land adjoins the Forest Service and that type of thing. But it also recognizes these scientific principles that are broadly accepted in the scientific community, that we need to reconnect these core areas, and not just through the high elevation roadless lands, but further down through some restoration work in the mid elevations and low elevations as well. And so it's not a matter of no logging. You know, our board of directors, in fact, you know, has worked in the logging industry, and we've also worked for the Forest Service. We have members that ride snowmobiles and ATVs and whatnot. But in looking at that, it's a membership that are with us because they recognize there are times where we need to temper our own selfish needs and habits and pick up recreation and those kind of pursuits and logging to a certain degree in a way that does protect wildlife, not just pay lip service to it.
The Flathead, you know, a lot of it's critical habitat for lynx. It's critical habitat for bull trout. And so these are designations that are really important to these species that are imperiled. I mean, they're on the endangered species list because they're in decline. And their habitat has been, this is the important habitat for them. And so I think that really needs to be the premier driver of what goes on this forest is what's good for wildlife, water quality, and fish, because we do have these extraordinary resources.
The Forest Service said roughly 500,000 acres is appropriate for logging. They're talking about 28 million board feet a year. Stoltz folks say that should be closer to 40 or 50 million board feet a year. Do you look at it in terms of those numbers that makes for an easy comparison of how your views differ from theirs?
Well, I think another major difference is we believe in fiscal responsibility on the part of the Forest Service. And the Forest Service wants as big a budget as it can get, you know, in this forest plan so it can ask for more money from Congress. And the timber industry is interested in having this inflated timber base for the same reasons. And the rest of us as taxpayers pay for it. The Congressional Research Service found that on the Flathead Forest, you lose about $122 for every 1,000 board feet of timber. That doesn't sound like much, but you multiply it times that 28 million board feet per year that this plan proposes, that's a loss of about $3.4 million each year pursuing this timber in these backcountry areas, especially way around in Sullivan Creek and up the South Fork by Spotted Bear. And so that's what the Forest Service wants. That's what the timber industry wants. But it's a tremendous expense to the taxpayer to try and maintain all those roads, prepare all those timber sales, reforest those areas afterwards and whatnot.
Well, and mentioning roads, I think that's one of the key things, is this plan does not really address their bloated road system. They don't have enough money to maintain the roads they have, and yet they want to put these roads into this maintenance level that allows them to leave culverts behind, closed roads, and that will lead to degradation of water quality and fish habitat, because eventually those culverts, if they're not maintained, will blow out. Even on roads that are maintained, they blow out. But so, you know, that's they're not addressing one of the key factors in wildlife habitat fragmentation, fish quality, water quality, and our water quality, by allowing all these roads to still remain on the landscape. We can create jobs by taking out these roads. We don't have to keep them and have them be a detriment to wildlife.
It sounds like in your analyses that you guys don't have specific numbers in mind of, you know, X number of acres are appropriate for logging, or X million board feet are appropriate timber harvest level. You look at it in not necessarily those numerical kinds of terms, right?
We look at it in a holistic manner, you know, just it's not that. Yeah, it's going to cubby into this many board feet. You know, we look at holistically on the landscape, not having a target that, okay, we have to meet this target every year no matter what. And I think that kind of mentality is not good for wildlife, fish, or water quality.
And part of it's just our capabilities. We don't have geographic information system capabilities in a small nonprofit like ours. And so we have to rely on the Forest Service's numbers when they crunch them out. So we're hopeful that they will crunch those kind of numbers with our citizen revision. But again, to go back to the 2006 draft revised plan, that was a very significant step on the part of the Forest Service to say, here's how we're going to address the controversy over protecting all of these other resources and having a reliable logging program, is by not having so many of these marginal areas in our timber base. And what they've done is they've totally reneged on that. They've doubled again or reinflated the timber base. And all of that promises more and more and ever lasting controversy, rather than what they tried to do in 2006 was to lower that level of controversy and come up with something more reliable for the timber industry. You know, inflating the timber base is not necessarily the most reliable way to produce timber on the flathead, and it certainly isn't the way to protect fish and wildlife.
So in terms of, again, the numbers of acres that the Forest Service is suitable, or the amount of timber that they're saying is appropriate, are those off by orders of magnitude? Do you feel like those numbers would be more appropriate at some percentage of what the Forest Service is saying, or can you even really look at it that way?
I guess I can't. I have a hard time looking at it that way, to throw like a number out, because I don't, like he said, I don't have the GIS capabilities. I don't have the models and all the things that they run.
So it's not as simple as saying we think the Forest Service is calling for twice as much logging as appropriate, or twice as many acres as appropriate for logging.
No, I mean, I think the first thing we can say is to say that on the order of the 2006 draft, or probably less, would be what we would see as being acceptable in terms of timber harvest.
And that's
really round numbers. That number at that time was 328,000 acres in the suitable timber base. And so that's about as round of numbers as we can talk. Like I say, in part, we're kind of held hostage but that's part of what this process is for. We'll be recommending to the Forest Service that when they do their draft EIS on this proposed plan, they need to have a broad range of other alternative plans that they look at. We want them to look at that 2006 draft plan that they put out as one benchmark. We'd like them to look at the Wildlife Conservation Society's proposal in terms of wildlife connectivity through roadless lands and recovered wildlands. And we think those will serve as very useful benchmarks to then we can answer these questions. But that's the Forest Service's job, is to do that kind of analysis, provide those kind of numbers, and then have a healthy public debate over it.
Well, and I guess that's what I'd add to what Keith said. This is a draft proposed action. It throws these numbers out there, but it really doesn't, it's like, substantiate them, analyze how they got to that point. So in before we could like really answer that question of how much, I think we need to see what that analysis entailed. And this doesn't, you know, isn't necessarily an analysis. It's a proposed action, draft proposed action.
So in your eyes, the numbers that are in the draft action aren't backed up by sound science?
I can't say that. I haven't seen the analysis. And that's where the environmental impact statement will lay that out. How did they come up with this? And then also, as Keith said, then they have to look at other alternatives and say, well, which one is better? And then they have to actually select the environmental, they have to identify what the environmentally most sound alternative is. Doesn't mean they necessarily have to select it, but they have to identify that. So this is just the very beginning of this process. You know, this is them putting it out there, asking for comment. They still have a lot of analysis and a lot of work to do to kind of back up what's in their proposed action, what might be changed in their proposed action based on public comment.
A goal for you guys is that at least one of the proposed alternatives for the environmental impact statement reflects the kinds of values you're talking about, the wildlife conservation and the best science to conserve the national forest. And do I have that right?
Yeah, I would make 2 points here in trying to nail down a few numbers or at least relativity. In the 1986 plan, which is actually still the plan they're working under, even though it's been amended 26 times, I think, in separate areas, the environmental impact statement there found that the most fiscally responsible and conservative alternatives that they looked at was the most acres that they recommended for wilderness, because those acres are the cheapest to manage, and that the most expensive alternatives were the ones that had the largest suitable timber base, because it requires roads to manage those acres. So we would expect to see similar findings in this draft EIS when they get to it in the coming year. One other figure that I would throw out is they have the flathead forest in recent years receives at best about 40% of the budget it needs to maintain its existing road system. And so that both fiscally and environmentally is not sustainable. But this plan would keep all of those roads. They don't intend to get rid of any more roads on the Flathead National Forest, and instead their proposal is to delist the grizzly bear and do away with those standards that would require them to incrementally keep chipping away at decommissioning some of those roads for the sake of bull trout and fisheries, as well as grizzly bear and other wildlife.
If what's important now is to come up with one of the alternatives in the environmental impact statement that reflects your values, what do you think the odds are that that will be the one that is selected? Because politically, maybe it's just my jaded point of view, I don't see that happening.
Well, the importance of having these alternatives, be it the Wildlife Conservation Societies or our citizen revision, is it helps us answer these questions that we can't answer for you today. The agency is bound by law in the National Environmental Policy Act to do a fair comparison between those alternatives. And they will have those figures in that draft EIS if they do their job well, that we could answer these questions. A year from now, hopefully we can sit down and answer these very questions if they have that broad range of alternatives in the draft environmental impact statement.
And I would add that that we have included alternatives we've suggested in other like Amendment 21 to the Forest Plan had an alternative that we suggested, and we actually worked with the Forest Service on. So in terms of getting an amendment, an alternative in there, I think that it's very reasonable to ask for that. Obviously, what they choose is going to be, you know, that's another whole issue that I don't have any control over. But, you know, I'm just trying to get the best alternative, the best standards, the best habitat maintained and or restored for wildlife.
How optimistic are you that the kind of management you're advocating for will actually be adopted as the forest plan?
Well, I think the likelihood of it in this political environment is really slim. But the importance of having that fair analysis among a broad range of alternatives is that it most certainly, at a minimum, should move the agency away from this forest plan into something that's far more protective of fish and wildlife and water quality.
I guess that's a question for Joe Kruger, because he has control of that.
Yeah, all I can say is that we introduced this alternative. We worked really hard late in 2013, and we put this out in the early part of
March. Of March 2014, during the collaborative meetings.
Yeah, so that we could deliver this to those collaborative meetings that the Forest Service was holding and that we were attending as often as possible. So we tried to get it in early, get it discussed, and make it part of the groundwork rather than the Johnny-come-lately, oh, well, at the 12th hour, we think you should think this way, not that way.
I would also add we have over 100 endorsements from scientists, economists, citizens, businesses that endorse and support this citizen revision.
So tell me more about this collaborative effort to write the new forest plan. I've had it described to me as we tried it and it didn't work, or we tried it and it was valuable. They may not have achieved the goal they set at the beginning. You guys were involved in the collaborative process. How'd that work out?
Well, at the front end, the first meeting, I think, was positive, because the Forest Service made the promise at that first meeting that they would make it very clear to everyone, whoever would come into these meetings, here's the legal and scientific sideboards that we need to operate within. And by the second meeting, those were out the window, and this just became a feeding frenzy. Just tell us what you want. We're here to give everybody as much as we can give them. And then that's where it fell down on not giving due consideration to fish, wildlife, and water quality. So it almost started off on the right foot, and then we just saw the thing just turn around 180 degrees and become a feeding frenzy.
Yeah, and I mean, and it started to break everybody up into smaller groups that then it's like you didn't know what was going on at that other table over there. I don't think it was a productive process myself. I think when they had the bus tours, we were all on a bus and we went to the different areas on the Flathead, and there were conversations and presentations on that. I think that was very helpful and very informative. When it came to just sort of the everybody sitting down, it was, as Keith said, a feeding frenzy of just, I want this, I want this, I want this. It's like it was me instead of looking at, okay, here's what's good for the land.
So that process was attempted and it didn't work out the way folks wanted it to. So we're left with the process we have now, sort of the conventional public input process to write these forest plans. How effective do you guys feel that is at achieving a good forest plan?
Well, I think that the NEPA process always had to be done. The collaborative process wasn't in place of the NEPA process. So, you know, I think that we have that NEPA is a good law. I think that it's a look before you leap. It's okay, let's look at what are the consequences of actions. And I think that's really important and necessary at this level, the forest plan level, as well as on the project level.
Yeah, I think what's important for the public to understand is this is the beginning of the real process where everybody, it's a citizen of the United States, has a voice in this by writing in or sending an email or going on the website for the Flatted Forest, filling out a comment form. And the collaborative stuff was weighted heavily toward people that could drive to a meeting or willing to jump on a plane and fly to Kalispell 12 or 14 times over a single winter. And that process really is not fair to the general public and our democratic process. So this is really where the rubber hits the road. And here, the compliance with the law and the science, which is really the only true voice Fish and Wildlife get in this process, is that conjuncture of the law and the science. That has to happen here, whereas it didn't have to happen in collaboration, and it didn't.
So as long as we're talking about NEPA and the law, you know, I think there's a popular perception that, you know, quote unquote environmentalists or quote unquote radical environmentalists, all they do is file lawsuits, you know, and they're always gumming up the works because they're always filing lawsuits. From the point of view of folks who have filed lawsuits and been successful, use them as tools to achieve goals, how do you see lawsuits as a tool, and are they a tool that that might be appropriate to achieving a plan for the Flathead National Forest that is appropriate, I guess?
Well, I think it's that misconception that, oh, all it takes to, you know, file an appeal or a lawsuit is a you know, stamp, postage stamp, and you send it in, and that's far, far from the truth. We, as you know, both our organizations, we are involved in projects, planning, policy from the very beginning. We're involved. We go out on the ground with the Forest Service. We go out on the ground and look at it for a project, proposed units. We meet with the agency. We try to do everything we can to get that project or plan to be the best that it can, so it doesn't negatively impact fish and wildlife. And so I think it's just a cheap shot when people say, oh, you just file lawsuits off, you know, like it's nothing. It's something we take really seriously. And you know, you can look, there are many projects that have gone through on the Flathead that were not litigated. And you know, the ones that are ones that we feel very strongly are not good for fish, wildlife, or water quality. And then, you know, other things where, I mean, lawsuits were successful in getting protection for the bull trout, for getting critical habitat for the bull trout. That took numerous lawsuits over 20 years to get there. And I think that, you know, they're an important part of our legal system.
So lawsuits are important when they're necessary. And like Arlene was pointing out, I mean, probably by the time we ever get to the point of filing a lawsuit on, say, a timber sale that we haven't been able to resolve our differences, we've probably got at least $10,000 or more invested in going out on the ground, going to meetings, reading the documents, and on and on and on. We want to see these things resolved up front, and that's why this forest plan is so important. That's why doubling this suitable timber base since the 2006 draft is so harmful. That basically escalates the likelihood that there will be more and more timber sale lawsuits because they're being planned in these marginal areas where it conflicts with bull trout, water quality, lynx, wolverine, grizzly bear. And by in 2006, having looked at a smaller timber base that left some of those contentious areas out, that would have been a step in the right direction to having far less litigation on the Flathead and on other national forests were they to follow that lead.
You know, both of Montana's senators, you know, they both feel that there needs to be a lot more timber harvested from national forests in Montana. And they're both, you know, John Tester has his Forest Jobs and Restoration Act, and Steve Daines has been talking about coming up with some kind of legislation to increase the amount of timber coming off of public lands. So does that concern you? You know, we have this public process to come up with these forest plans and determine how the public lands are going to be used, but then we have the two senators seeming, you know, inserting themselves or trying to go beyond that, or at least that's how I see it. I wonder how you see the efforts of Montana's senators in in public lands, I guess, national forest management?
I think it's bad policy. You know, that they talk, you know, they might rail against, oh, we need bottom up and we don't want Washington top down. Well, that's the epitome of Washington top down. It's not looking at what is the capability of the forest to produce some products, but yet protect the wildlife and the amenities that are really the drivers in the Flathead Valley. I mean, over 2 million people come to Glacier Park and the Flathead every year to catch a glimpse of a grizzly bear. I mean, it's like you people are so excited when they get to see a bear, you know, but they don't come to see big clear cuts. So I think that that it's really misguided for the Congress to be sort of inserting itself into setting mandatory levels of logging without having gone through the analysis.
Yeah, and I would just concur in that. And that's, again, I keep coming back to the suitable timber base on the Flathead. But this plan and why it's so important that it be corrected, it basically inflates the timber base to twice the size they proposed in 2006 and are basically saying, Congress, there's a bigger area to throw your money at. And with the things that Senator Daines in particular is saying, or the precedent that Senator Tester would set with his Forest Jobs and Recreation Act, they want to mandate that logging level on the national forests. And that's our concern of what will happen here by having an artificially inflated timber base and then that kind of attention from our senators to mandate the logging level on the Flathead Forest and basically pay lip service that, but this will also, you know, protect water quality and fish and grizzly bears.
So as veterans of these forest planning processes, for members of the public who are concerned about these issues but maybe not as deep into it as you two are, if they want to have some influence or participate in this process or see their values reflected in the forest plan, where are we on that process, and what's your advice to those folks who want to positively impact the forest plan?
Well, my advice is that everyone that loves their national forest for their reason should write an email or a letter to the addresses on the Flathead's website, on the Flathead Forest website. And then while they're at it, you know, take that letter, whether it's talking about, here's the area I really love to recreate, I'd rather it not have snowmobiles, and I'd rather it be more secure for grizzly bears and wolverine. And then turn that also into a letter to the editor and send it around to the various newspapers, or go online with the radio stations, whatnot, comment on interviews like this. There's many ways that people can get that word out there. And frankly, sometimes I think our members of Congress pay more attention to that than a letter sent directly to their inbox in their office.
Yeah, and I think people need to let the Forest Service know how important it is to have these lands that support this wildlife. These animals that were here when Lewis and Clark came through, and now, you know, I mean, where else do you find this full suite of species? You know, it's the Flathead is so unique and so wonderful in that it has that. And why would you want to do anything to jeopardize that? I think that people's love of the land and love of wildlife and needs to kind of come through to the agencies as well, instead of just perhaps just what I want to do. It's like, well, what's best for the wildlife that have nowhere else to go.
Okay. I don't have other questions unless there's something you think we missed or something you think is really important for people to know.
I just like to say that what I found in looking at this draft plan is it's really needs to have more metrics and standards that will actually measure impacts. It's just not there. Everything is a lot of discretion to the agency, and we have, you know, words like avoid or you may maybe don't do this, but instead of like, well, how about some standards for stream habitat? How about standards for old growth and whether it's really supporting species? And so I think that that's one of the real deficiencies in this draft.
Well, I guess the kind of the remaining thing on my mind is that the public needs to not get discouraged. You know, government, unfortunately, is largely about money and getting industry what it wants. And it's been that way for a long time. And that's part of what we're faced with here. Senator Daines is number 8 among the recipients of timber industry contributions to his campaign. And he's doing, you know, that's what we see, you know, is that he's doing that bidding. And it just takes that groundswell of people in a democratic process to weigh in with their voice to help counterbalance the money that's going on. And so I just would tell people, don't get discouraged. You know, this is a lifelong process for all of us, you know, to weigh in on all these issues with Congress and with the administration and to be active down on the ground level with the Forest Service.
Keith and Arlene, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thank you. We appreciate being able to talk to you and to your listeners.